Hello, my name is Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul-Satisfying Work. I'm also the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website, and I'm working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. This is podcast number 79. I'm recording it on Friday, January 22nd, 2009. The PE10 level today is 14. That's fair value. Stocks purchased at today's prices offer a strong long-term value proposition. The title of this podcast is, What Should You Be Investing In When You're Not Investing in Stocks? Feels good to be back in the saddle recording another podcast. I got pulled away from the podcast. I've been recording them like a madman since the price crash. It wasn't ever my intent to record so many podcasts. I had started doing these thinking I'd be recording one a week or so. And then shortly after I started recording the podcast, we had the stock crash, and that's generated all sorts of interest in new investing ideas and all sorts of questions among people seeking financial freedom early in life. So I've sort of been pulled in, and it's become my standard practice to record three or four of these a week. But this past week, I've been busy with a different project. I've been spending most of my time on a calculator, a fourth investing calculator that I'm developing with John Walter Russell, the owner of the site at early-retirement-planning-insights.com. And John and I have, this is the fourth calculator we've done. It's called the Investment Strategy Tester. We've changed the name, but so if you've heard me talk about it before, we were using a different name, but the current name is Investment Strategy Tester. And it's a very exciting calculator. I'll describe it more on a later podcast, but basically if you're familiar with the Scenario Surfer, which is a calculator now available at the website, what it will allow you to do is to look at different strategies under that you currently look at using the strategy of the Scenario Surfer, and run 1,000 runs. With the Scenario Surfer, you're only running a single run, and you're seeing how a strategy works in one more or less random sequence of returns that could play out in the real world. But with the Strategy Tester, you get to do 1,000 runs, so you get a sense of the get a sense of the odds of various different outcomes. So it serves a different purpose than the Scenario Surfer. The Scenario Surfer lets you sort of make decisions on your stock allocation in a simulated environment. And you experience losses in your portfolio, and you see how you react, and you experience gains and see how you react, and that plays out over 30 years, and you see what strategy works best. And I think that's very valuable. It's a very valuable training tool. But strategy tester lets you then take one of those strategies that maybe you think will work based on your experience with the surfer, and run it 1,000 times and see what the odds are of a good outcome, because it might be that you just had a good outcome, that you were just lucky that one time. So, and compare. Of course, the great thing is you can compare lots of different strategies and see how they compare with each other. So I'm excited about that calculator. It's possible it will be out by the time this podcast is posted, although I wouldn't bet on that, but within the next few months in any event. It seems like we're getting close to the end, and it's been a long journey. It's been close to a year that we've been working on that one. It took a long time, but that one's going to be out soon. But so as a result, I've been busy with that, and I haven't done any podcasts for about a week, and I've gotten to enjoy doing these, so I'm glad to be having a little time to do a podcast today. I received an email, and it was just about a week ago, last Saturday, from a woman, Colleen, and she asked a question that I don't often get asked. the investing ideas at the site are controversial. They shouldn't be, but they are. They're based on research that's been done over the past 30 years by Robert Shiller and many others, starting around 1981, so almost 30 years, that show that valuations affect long-term returns, and that therefore, passive investing, the idea of sticking with a single stock allocation regardless of stock valuations, does not make sense, and in fact cannot work in the real world. All of the investing advice at the site is based on that idea, based on that research, based on that line of thinking. And as I say, it's controversial only because passive investing became so popular during the out-of-control bull market that now we're in this situation where if we acknowledge what this research teaches us, we are on the threshold of the golden age of middle-class investing. It's all good stuff for many years to come, learning all these exciting things that we didn't know about investing back before 1981, when we were properly in the passive investing era. We're still in the passive investing era today. It's still the dominant idea, but it's a failed idea. So once research came out showing that valuations affect long-term returns, the entire intellectual framework for passive investing had fallen to the ground, and we should have abandoned it then, or at least started to. We should have at least started exploring new ideas. But unfortunately, we humans didn't do that. And we got all caught up in an out-of-control bull market and lost large portions of our life savings. And we're now dealing with the ramifications that those mistakes had on our economy as a whole, and trying to dig ourselves out of this ditch. But because these ideas strike people as unusual, they haven't heard them much for the past 30 years or so. Usually I'm asked questions about valuations, sometimes hostile, sometimes not, sometimes very kind. But almost always the questions directed at me have something to do with the valuation question. This question that was sent to me last week by Colleen was not of that nature. She was asking the question posed in the title of this podcast. She basically was saying, I want to follow your approach, or the approach, it's not really my approach, but the approach you describe, let's say, the rational investing approach or the valuation-informed indexing approach. And one of the things you do when you're a valuation-informed indexer is you sometimes invest heavily in stocks, and at other times you don't invest heavily in stocks. And she was asking what she should be invested in at the times when she is not invested in stocks. So let me just read what Colleen wrote. She says, I have recently begun researching, learning about investing. I was hooked on the idea of index investing, but something inside me made me wonder, too good to be true? And what's the downside? Boy, this is an intelligent woman. This is those are smart instincts that she has. I wish everyone had those instincts. I happened onto your site, and value-informed indexing seems to make sense. Here's my question. And another thing I like here that evidences the intelligence of this woman is that she doesn't say value-informed indexing is the answer to my dream. She says, seems to make sense. That's a nice way of putting it. You know, the suggestion there, she's going to study it a little more before she puts actual money at risk, and that's 100% the right way to go. Here's my question. I was looking into three index funds from Vanguard, an international fund, a total stock market fund, and a bond index fund. And I'm wondering if value-informed indexing could be applied within these three. Basically investing heavily in the international and total stock market funds now, and when they go up, when valuations go up, she means, to transfer a percentage over to the bond fund. Am I understanding, or would I need to be in something other than the bond index funds? Also, I was wondering how you are doing today and if you have posted since the market turned in the past few months. So I take it that she came into the site, probably she did a search for index investing and found an article. I have an article, The Pros and Cons of Index Investing. So if you did a Google search for the the pros and cons of indexing, you might be led to my article. And she probably didn't discover the blog, so she's not aware of my, you know, that my more recent comments since the stock crash. So she's sort of, I think she's asking how I, you know, what I think about all that. So I'll read my answer, and then I'm going to expand on that for the remainder of the podcast. I say, you know, Colleen, thanks for visiting the site. Thanks for writing. For my thoughts on the market crash, please click on the A Rich Life button at the left side of each page of the site. That's where my blog is located. I've been posting every business day. My focus in recent months has been on recording podcasts. So you could also click on the Robcast section and just listen to whatever titles seem of interest. I've commented extensively on the price crash in the first 50 podcasts. I believe that what you're asking is, what should I be invested in as the alternative to stocks at times when stock prices are too high? The conventional recommendation is to go with bonds as the alternative to stocks. My preference is for Treasury inflation-protected securities, TIPS, purchased at times when they are providing a solid long-term return. But I see this as being a judgment call. A case can be made for bonds in some circumstances. To work through the points pro and con, TIPS or bonds, would take an entire article. I'll put that on my list for the future. The analysis is, which option best counters stocks? I like TIPS better, because what I am trying to counter is the unpredictability of stocks. TIPS are the most predictable asset class I can think of. However, I haven't worked this particular question hard enough to have a strong opinion. I tentatively prefer TIPS as my stock counter, but I can see circumstances in which bonds might make sense. It might also be possible to use both as counters. You're asking an interesting question that we have not explored in much depth. You might want to direct your question to John Walter Russell as well. John is my partner in development of the calculators. His site is earlyretirementplanninginsights.com. He has a letters to the editor section. I know he would be glad to take on your question, and I would like to hear what he says about it. My guess is that he might have a better informed take on this particular question than I am able to offer. You'll be helping other community members by asking him about it, as I am sure there are others who are also wondering about this. Welcome to the Financial Freedom Community. After I wrote that response, I was in the shower and started mulling it over a little bit in my head, and came to the conclusion that it made sense to do a full podcast on it. And I still won't give a complete answer because I haven't done the intense study that I would like to do to really give a definitive answer to the question, but I think I can offer some additional thoughts. Here it goes. The investing model that I recommend, I call rational investing. Rational investing is the alternative to passive investing. Passive investing says valuations don't matter. You stay at the same stock allocation regardless of price. When prices are reasonable, you have a stock allocation. You're at that same stock allocation when prices are insanely dangerous. Makes no difference. Rational investing says no. Rational investing says you must change your stock allocation when prices reach insanely dangerous levels. You must. If you want to have a realistic chance of long-term success. When you change, see, this is a hard concept to grasp, so I try to repeat it, but when you change your thinking on valuations, you don't change your thinking on one question about how to invest. You don't change your position on one topic. When you change your thinking on valuations, you change every strategic question that there is relating to investing. You change everything. I guess I'd like to think, if I could, of a comparison that I could make in the outside world where changing one thing just changes everything. You could possibly apply it to climate change, but I mean a dramatic, you know, say that say that you moved to Alaska, you know, where it's cold all the time, or you moved, you know, to the equator where it's hot all the time. I mean, you would have changes in all sorts of behavior. Your obviously, you might not go out and see friends as often because it's so cold, you know. You know, if you're near the equator, maybe, you know, culturally, you would adopt a sort of siesta policy where people would not work in the afternoon because it's just too hot to be out working. There are certain changes that I don't know that either of those are the best examples. I'm not happy with those examples, but maybe an example would be having children. You know, when you have children, it doesn't change everything in your life, but it changes an awful lot. You don't get up and go to a movie the way you did before you had children because you have to hire a babysitter. And, you tend to just say it's not worth it. So, you know, maybe you order a movie, maybe you bring a movie home and watch video, but you don't go out to the movies after you have children. Or when you do, it's an event. So it's a different sort of situation. It changes the nature of the experience. And it just does that in all kinds of ways. It changes how you feel about your job. When you have kids to support, you're not going to just quit a job on a whim because, you know, you get annoyed with your boss. Changes also, you start to worry about money because you're thinking, a lot of people won't save for their own retirement. They just can't be motivated. But when it comes to, you know, helping their kids with their college expenses, that motivates them. They start to save when they have kids. So having kids can just change everything. Being married, of course, can change everything. The step from being single to being married can change everything. So anyway, the point here is when you start taking valuations into consideration in developing your investing strategies, all of the old rules are off the books. So we can't just say, oh, it's been conventional wisdom for many years now, that bonds are the alternative to stocks. That just doesn't hold. The rules that we're learning new things about investing. We've learned lots of new things. The trouble we've had in recent years is, you know, taking the knowledge in. People don't want to acknowledge that they didn't know everything from the first day, and so there's a resistance to new knowledge, and I try to fight that in every way I can. But when new knowledge comes in, we have to abandon the old knowledge. The two things go together. So the idea that bonds are the alternative to stocks is the conventional wisdom. And it's not necessarily wrong. This isn't conventional wisdom that is, you know, exceedingly dangerous like the wisdom of the passive investing era that you don't need to change your stock allocation in response to big price changes. That's dangerous conventional wisdom. The idea that bonds are the alternative to stocks is not dangerous. And I think there are times when it is probably true. But it is not something we should just take as without questioning. It's something that should be questioned. Now, one big reason why it should be questioned is we didn't have the options that are available to us today when the conventional wisdom that bonds are the alternative to stocks was developed. That conventional wisdom goes back a long, long ways. And There were no TIPS, Treasury Inflation Protected Securities, in the days when that became conventional wisdom. There were no I-bonds. I don't know whether there were certificates of deposit. There was probably something along those lines. But the options were not as... there are many different... with computers, you can search. You can get the best rate on certificates of deposit today in a way that you couldn't in earlier days. So even there, there's a significant change. You know, what matters is the rate you get, not the average rate. So, you know, if you had some academic studying, how do people do who invest in certificates of deposit, what they will do is they'll plug in the average. But that's not the rate that applies for you if you're willing to put a little elbow grease into it. The way to analyze these questions is to look at what you actually can get in the real world. And having the computer available to do research on the best rates increased the rate you can obtain from a certificate of deposit. That's just a fact. That's the number you should use in doing this sort of analysis. That's the kind of mistake I see all the time when I examine the investing literature, just all the time. These painfully obvious basic things are overlooked. You don't need to have an IQ of 140 to understand that if the average rate on a certificate of deposit is 4%, and yet there's a bank offering me 5%, that I need to be comparing what I can get from stocks with the 5% number, not the 4% number. But look at a lot of academic studies and you'll see them do it the other way. So my preference, my first choice, let's put it that way, my first choice in trying to determine what I would invest in as an alternative to stocks, my first choice would be TIPS. My second choice would be I-bonds. My third choice would be certificates of deposit, and bonds would probably only be my fourth choice. And there are probably other choices that could be considered. But I would, that doesn't mean that I would always choose TIPS. That's the first thing I would look at. And then I would sort of go down the list. And if I wasn't happy with what I could get from TIPS, I would look at I-bonds more closely. And if I wasn't happy with I-bonds, I would look at certificates of deposit. And if I wasn't happy with certificates of deposit, I would look at bonds. Now, that doesn't mean, I don't want to suggest by that, that that's what everyone else should do. It depends on your circumstances, on your knowledge, on how much effort you're willing to put into the task, all sorts of things. So there is no one rule. But I think there's a reason why I am attracted to TIPS and I-bonds. So it might help if I give that reason. And that is that, to understand where I'm coming from, you see, there's a reason why so much of my investing advice is not the conventional advice. The reason is I come at these investing questions from a different place than most so-called experts. And I don't consider myself an expert. I'm a journalist. I report on what other quote-unquote experts say, but I don't really consider anyone in this field an expert today, truth be told. I just don't think our knowledge of the subject matter is sufficiently advanced for anyone to be calling himself or herself an expert, but I certainly do not call myself that. But I come at this from a different place, and you know, I come at this from a saving perspective. What happened with me is I'm just an ordinary middle-class worker, journalist, and I suffered a job loss back in the early 1990s. Did not like the feeling of vulnerability that resulted from that. And I vowed to learn how to avoid ever being put in that situation again. And so I studied these personal finance questions, and that led me to the book by Joe Dominguez, Your Money or Your Life. And that book has changed many people's lives, changed mine, taught me some things about money that I very much needed to learn, told me that I could achieve financial freedom early in life. And so when I look at investing, I'm not looking at, a lot of people just come into it with this idea of, oh, I want to do charts, I want to do numbers, I want to solve intellectual puzzles. And that's not me. What I wanted to do was to put together a plan to achieve financial freedom early in life so that I could choose what to do with the hours of my day instead of having to work for an employer to pay the bills to stay alive. That's where I'm coming at it. Joe Dominguez addresses that question in his book. He has a chapter on investing. It's often ridiculed by so-called stock experts. It's ridiculed for bad reasons. However, it is flawed for a different reason. So I'll just go through that real quickly. I don't want to spend time on it. There's a separate podcast that I did that was called What I Learned About Investing from Your Money or Your Life. So if you're interested in that, please go to that earlier podcast. But Joe Dominguez urged people to invest in treasury bonds. I don't think that's what Colleen is asking about. I don't think she's speaking strictly about treasury bonds. But Joe Dominguez, there's a reason why he told people to invest in treasury bonds. And if you understand that, you know, I think you'll understand some things that follow from it. What Joe was trying to do is he saved enough money so that he would never have to work again in a corporate environment. He wanted to work on environmental causes, nonprofit activities. He saved enough money to do that at age 40. I believe age 30, 39 or 41, something like that. Close to 40. He didn't want to be invested in something as volatile as stocks, because you can't hand in your resignation. You know, if you use a corporate job to finance your lifestyle, you can't hand in a resignation not knowing whether the money's going to be there next year or in 3 years or in 5 years or in 10 years. You need stability. This is what the chapter written by Dominguez is all about. It's all about, you know, I've saved X amount of money. I want to leave my job, but I don't dare do it if this money's in stocks and I don't know where I'm going to stand tomorrow. That different perspective is the reason why all the investing advice at my site is different from what you usually hear, I believe. I started from a different place, so of course I ended up in a different place. Most people aren't thinking about it that way. These people that advocate passive investing, they're saying, you know, put most of your money in stocks and it'll all work out fine. And the truth is, if you go 30 years out, they're right. If you put it all in stocks and you don't look at it for 30 years, they're right. But I just think that's totally unrealistic. That's why the subtitle of the book I'm working on is, you know, how to make what works on paper work in the real world. This passive investing stuff is not the real world. None of us can live for 30 years without wanting to see some growth in our portfolio. So the 30-year idea just doesn't hack it. Just doesn't. We care about what happens to our money in 1 year, in 5 years, in 10 years, in 15 years, in 20 years, not just 30 years. And all of the passive investing advice is based on that 30-year concept. All of it. And that's why it's all wrong. That's why it doesn't work. So Dominguez, long before, this was 19, and oh, he wrote his book. Well, he didn't write the book. The book didn't come out until the early 90s, but he developed his ideas back in the late 1960s. So he was developing this stuff before passive investing even became popular, these ideas. So he wasn't answering passive investing. He was just trying to figure out what to do. He knew that he couldn't put his money in stocks because the stability wasn't there. And so he came up with the idea of putting it in treasury bonds. And the reason he chose treasury bonds is that it was at that time the safest investment class available. Treasury bonds are rock solid safe because they're guaranteed by the US government. The only way you won't get your money back is if the government fails. And, you know, that could happen, but there's nothing safer than that. So that's why he recommends treasury bonds. Now, he was ridiculed because when the book was published years later, he didn't intend to publish a book. He came up with these ideas for his own use. And then some people asked him how he pulled off what he did. How did you retire at age 40? And he scribbled down some notes and told people what he did. And then those notes became so popular, they were eventually turned into a book that was published in the early 90s. But it wasn't his intent to write a book in the beginning. So, you know, when the book came out, he developed the ideas in the 1960s. When the book came out, it was the middle of the most out of control bull market in history. So now people looked at these ideas and they said, well, great book, Your Money or Your Life, wonderful book, but this chapter on investing is a little weird. What's this stuff about? Stocks aren't always the best investment imaginable? What? Hasn't he read the papers? Doesn't he ever watch television? Does this guy not know anything? You know, he was saying perfectly reasonable things. But in an environment in which everybody paying attention to investing had gone stark, raving, bonkers nuts. So people thought he was nuts. There's nothing wrong with what Joe says in that chapter. Well, there is something, but the general thing he says is not wrong. The general thing he says is right. That if you're going to retire early, you have to have stability. And I want to put in, I don't know if he'll take it the right way or not, but I want to put in a little plug for my friend John Graney. John Graney was trying to do the same thing at his website, retireearlyhomepage.com. You know, this is where all our troubles began because I questioned John Graney's study. The reason I was drawn to John Graney's website in the first place is because I was trying to figure out how to tackle these issues, just as, you know, Dominguez had been back in the 60s when I was putting together my plan. And so, of course, I was excited to find what Dominguez did. I was also excited to find what John Graney did. John Graney took a different approach to the same problem. Graney knew, just like Dominguez knew, anyone who retires early knows this, but if you've never retired early, you might not realize it. But retiring early means handing in a resignation from a job that is your lifeline. Your food and your electricity come from that job and your health insurance. And you're cutting it. You're taking scissors and cutting it. So you've got to know what's on the other side. And just saying, dum-de-dum, I got some money in stocks. Hope it goes up, but might go down. 30 years, it'll be good. Dum-de-dum. That's not good enough. You can't. What are you going to do? The time comes to pay your electric bill, you're going to tell the electric company, oh, I'll give you your money in 30 years. I read something by Eugene Fama. He said I'd have my money back in 30 years, so... Can you wait? No rush is there. Yeah, they want the money now. They want the money this month. You're going to get hungry this month, not 30 years from now. So, Joe Dominguez tried to solve the problem of the lack of stability of stocks by recommending treasury bonds. John Graney had a different approach. He tried to solve it through what's called a safe withdrawal rate study. So what John said was, well, I'm not going to give up stocks. You see, John came along later than Dominguez, and stocks were the rage when John was putting his plan. So he said, I'm going to be in stocks. I'm not going to do what that crazy Dominguez guy said. But John was trying to solve the stability problem, the lack of stability problem. So he said, what I'll do is look at the worst case scenario. I'm going to put my money in stocks, but I'm going to see what's the worst that could happen. If I take out the amount of money I need to live on every month, and I'm going to assume the worst case in terms of stock performance, and if I still have enough, you know, to live whatever number of years I expect to have remaining in my life, if all those conditions are met, I'm gold. You know, stability is not a problem. I might lose money in the early years. Stocks might go down. I don't care. I've planned for the worst case scenario. That's the best I can do. And I think that's good enough. And the logic there, I think, is very strong. I have no problem with John's logic. That's why I was drawn to his site. That's why I started posting to the discussion board. He found it. Because I was excited by his work. I knew that he got the number wrong from the first day. Because I had already done some research and I knew this. But it didn't disturb me at the time. I didn't know it was going to be so controversial to correct what he did. I had no idea. I had some idea, but I had no idea how much. I knew it was going to be controversial, but I didn't know. There's no way any human being could have contemplated what was going to come. So Dominguez solved the problem one way. He said, avoid stocks. That's not really a satisfactory answer. And let me just tell you why. The reason is, Treasury bonds do what Dominguez wants, but Treasury bonds don't provide returns high enough to cover you. Safe investment classes. I explored safe investment classes because I love Dominguez so much and he recommended safety. I explored them. And what I found is that this is a very rough rule of thumb, but I think it's generally in the right neighborhood, is that if you want to go safe, you'll be able to find an investment class that will provide a annual real return of something around 3% real. Stocks provide a real return of a little in excess of 6% real on average. So stocks provide double. Now, if you want to retire early, and I wanted to do it as soon as possible, if you're going with an investment class that only gives you half the return, it's going to take you twice, you're going to have to save twice as much. So a plan where you could retire with $1 million in stocks is going to take you $2 million in treasuries. That's going to take a lot longer. Now, if you want to go that way, that's rock solid safe. Nothing wrong with it. But you got to understand there's a big cost in terms of years, decades maybe, that you're going to have to stay at a corporate job. And I didn't want that. So that was out. So that didn't work. Dominguez's approach didn't work. Now, Dominguez has an answer to that. What Dominguez does is he ignores the inflation factor. So if you ignore inflation, treasury bonds pay as much as stocks, and all this works. But to ignore inflation is just dangerous. It's just as dangerous as passive investing. It's crazy dangerous, frankly. And I love Joe Dominguez, but I'm afraid that idea does not work. So Dominguez's approach doesn't work. Nice try. He was trying to solve the problem. He put his finger on the right problem, but it doesn't work. John Graney, again, nice try, but it doesn't work. Graney's flaw, he counts inflation, so he didn't make the Dominguez mistake. But he made a different mistake. He didn't count valuations. So what he does is he says, you can take out 4%. That the worst case scenario with stocks, you can take out 4% real. So he moves his... He doesn't say, you know, the good thing you can say about what Graney did was he didn't tell people you can take out 6.5%, which is the average real return on stocks. He lowered that to 4, which is good. That's a big step in the right direction. But the number isn't 4. The number varies. The truth is the number varies. The number is sometimes as low as 2, even lower than the 3% that you could probably get from treasuries. It sometimes drops to 2. At other times, it rises as high as 9. So you can't just take one number. That was a mistake. And of course, the problem is, surprise, surprise, this approach became popular, you know, when the number was lowest, which is what's always going to happen, because these sorts of approaches are always going to catch on when stocks are most overpriced. And so, the moment when Graney's study was most popular, and it's not only him, lots of people have these studies, but the moment when it was most popular is the moment when it was most wrong. That's the way it works, I'm afraid, in investor world. So when Graney was telling, when everybody was rushing to Graney's site and, you know, linking to it like crazy and saying best site on the internet, that's the very time when the number was 2%, and he was saying it was 4, and when anybody using that study to plan their retirement was likely to suffer a failed retirement. So that approach also does not work. So what I have tried to do, and I believe I have succeeded, is to develop a third answer to the lack of stability problem. The answer that I use is called valuation-informed indexing, and so what this approach does is it says, well, you can't stay with the safe asset classes because generally you're only going to get 3% real, the safe asset classes. And even that can be hard at times. Sometimes it's hard to get 3%. But if you do a lot of work and you do a lot of research and you lock in a good return when it's available, you can probably get 3% real without taking on much risk. But that's not enough. You want 6. You want double. if you're going to try to retire early. So you've got to figure out a way to get six, not three. If you could, you know, if there were some way that you could wave a magic wand and have stocks provide the average long-term return, which is 6, or it's really 6.5, but let's just say 6, all your problems would be solved. You would invest in stocks, and you're good to go. But there's no magic wand that'll do that. Some years, stocks provide not 6, but 12% real. And other years, stocks provide not 6, but 3% real. And other years still, stocks provide not 12 or 3, but negative 40% real. You know, that's the problem. Valuation-informed indexing overcomes that problem. It doesn't do it by avoiding stocks, like Dominguez urged, and it doesn't do it by lying to yourself about the effect of valuations, as Graney does. Not, you know, lying. He lied to himself, not just to others. He deceived himself into thinking that valuations don't matter. And they do. What valuation-informed indexers do is they invest heavily in stocks at times when the returns are going to be super great. And of course they store that money aside. When, you know, during those years, when the P/10 level is 7 or 8, the most likely 10-year return is 17% real per year. Well, we don't spend. If you're a valuation-informed indexer and you're living on a retire early plan, you don't spend that 17% real a year. You only spend whatever the number is that you're pulling out, whether it's 4% or 5% or 6%, you only spend the smaller number. And your account, of course, accumulates, grows. And then when you have the years where your return is much less, you've got the money there. You've got the money there to, you know, to live on. So you have a in order to retire early, you need to have a constant income stream. You need stability in the income stream. But you don't really need the portfolio numbers to be stable. You just have to know that the portfolio numbers are going to be good enough to cover the outgo, to cover whatever your spending is going to be for the years. And you have to be willing to make certain assumptions or you can't do it, but the assumptions are totally reasonable ones. They're the same assumptions that Graney made in his study and that all these others have made. The assumption is that the U.S. economy will continue to be sufficiently productive to generate a real return for a broad market index of stocks of 6.5% real per year. That, if you don't buy into that, none of the rest works. But the difference from the passive approach, which is the approach followed by Graney, is that those who follow passive investing don't really get the 6.5. They, if they're lucky and they happen to start investing at the right time, they get more than that. If they're unlucky and they happen to start investing at a bad time, like January of 2000, they suffer massive wipeouts and it takes decades for them to catch up. But valuation-informed indexers take valuations into consideration. So we don't suffer massive wipeouts. We lower our stock allocation. And then we've got, when the time comes where stock returns again are attractive, as they are today, the long-term return is attractive, not the short-term, but the long-term, 10 years out. We then have the assets to invest in stocks because we didn't lose our portfolio in a crash. So that's the concept. Now, the reason why I need to go into all that to explain why I prefer TIPS and I-bonds to bonds as a general rule is that the reason why people choose bonds as the alternative to stocks is that bonds and stocks They both provide higher returns. All this is generalizing, but they both provide higher returns than the safe asset classes. Bonds are not really considered a super safe asset class like TIPS or I-bonds or CDs. They're closer to stocks, but they're not as risky as stocks. So what the conventional advice is to sort of balance, you know, stocks are too risky to go with all stocks. So the idea is go, well, maybe go half stocks, half bonds, or 60% stocks, 40% bonds, something like that. Maybe after you retire, they'd say go 60% bonds, 40% stocks. They're trying to combine risk and stability in a suitable overall mix. And that's fine. You know, there's nothing wrong with it, but I'd prefer to the extent I'm going to take risk, I'd rather take risk through stocks, because stocks provide generally higher returns than bonds. So I would rather have a higher stock allocation and forget about bonds. But in order to do that, you need to have a highly stable counter to stocks at times of high prices. And that's where TIPS come in. TIPS, the analytical question you really should be asking is, why do I want an alternative to stocks? Why don't I just put all my money in stocks? And the answer is, stocks, what the bond people would say is, stocks are too risky. Prices are too volatile. So bonds are less volatile, less risky. So you counter stocks with bonds. I would say stocks are they're too unpredictable. So what I want is predictability, and there's nothing more predictable than TIPS. TIPS, on the day you buy them, I bought 30-year TIPS. I don't think 30-year TIPS are still available, but they used to be. But if you buy 30-year TIPS, it's the most stable asset class you could have. It's got a government guarantee attached to it. You can write in advance what's going to happen for 30 years. It's more stable than a bond. See, bonds can do poorly during high inflation. So bonds have a risk component to them. And inflation is much worse in today's era, or economy, than it was in the days when bonds became so popular. Bonds are actually a fairly high-risk asset class at times. So I don't want to counter the risk of stocks with another kind of risk. Now, some people will say bonds do well at times when stocks do poorly, and vice versa. They counter each other. Sometimes that's true, but that's not always true. There are times when both bonds and stocks do well, and there are times when both bonds and stocks do poorly. There is no absolute rule on that. But TIPS are always stable. So when I'm counter, my attitude is I want to counter stocks to the least degree possible. I want to have as much in stocks as I can. But in order to have as much in stocks as I can, I need to counter stocks effectively. And TIPS are the best counter that I can think of. So I really like TIPS as my counter. And then once I've got the smoothing in the income stream that I need, then everything else I can put in stocks without worrying about it too much, because I've achieved my stability goal. So going with a counter that is more stable than bonds permits me to own more stocks, which means I have more growth, which means I can retire sooner. So that's the thinking involved in why I am drawn to TIPS. I'm drawn to I-bonds just because there are differences in TIPS and I-bonds that sometimes make I-bonds more attractive. And I don't want to go into the details, but the differences have to do with things like how they're taxed. They're taxed differently. How many you can buy in a given year. There are rules about how much you can buy, or at least there were when I bought them. I think those rules are still in effect. So things like that can be a hang up. You might say, I want to buy I-bonds, but I can only buy so many. So then you buy TIPS. You sort of have to work it out. You might be putting it into your 401k. And you might, because of the tax considerations, you would look at it differently. So you can research all that on the internet. There are government websites that will explain how TIPS work and how I-bonds work. But the concept is the same. The concept is an inflation-adjusted, stable income stream. And if If tips had been available when Joe Dominguez was putting together his plan, I am highly confident he would have recommended tips or I-bonds. The only reason he didn't is that they didn't exist. Because the problem he was trying to solve is solved by tips slash I-bonds. And so, see, I'm heavily influenced by Dominguez. I didn't go for his thing where you don't adjust for inflation, but tips and I-bonds adjust for inflation, so you're covered. The only difference I have really with Dominguez is, he would probably say to go solely with tips and I-bonds, and you would have total stability. It'd be a great plan. But the problem is you would not get the return you can get with valuation-informed indexing because you wouldn't have stocks. And so it would take a lot longer to put that plan together. If you can do it, by all means do it. But if you want to retire sooner, you can get there sooner with limited risk. It's not risk-free, but with limited risk, by combining the stable asset class with the growth class in a mix that gives you at least, it gives you income stability in a real sense. It doesn't give it in the sense, see, this is the thing I think people have a hard time grasping, although for me it's very easy to understand, but it's clear to me that many don't get it. Even many smart people don't get it, and people of goodwill. When you combine these two income classes, a high growth class with a high stability class, and you include a valuation adjustment so that you don't let the risk of stocks go off the charts. If you do that, your portfolio, the numbers don't grow every year. The numbers don't go up 6.5% every year. But there's a sense in which your portfolio is growing by that amount every year, even though it's not showing in the numbers. And the way that's working is, when, say that we have, right now we're at fair value in stocks. Say that we have a big drop over the next 5 years. Your portfolio amount would be going down. But in the real world, what you own is not going down. What you own are shares of businesses that are generating profits. Just because the numbers on the portfolio statement are going down doesn't mean that that asset has gone down in value. It's being given a lower value by emotional investors. But the value is increasing by roughly 6.5% real per year. So what you're doing, if you're living on that money in a retire early plan, what you're doing is you're saying, I am confident that the value of my portfolio has increased, even though the numbers are lower. And therefore, I'm going to continue withdrawing whatever amount made sense when I put the plan together, whether you're withdrawing 4% or 5%, whatever it happens to be. You can withdraw more than 4% if you put your plan together intelligently. 4% is, of course, safer than something else. But you can't, you can't do it the way Grainy does it. You can't take out 4%, and have a high stock allocation at times of insanely high prices. That won't work. Because at times of insanely high stock prices, the drop in portfolio value could be so immense that you can't recover from it. But if you invest at times, if you invest in stocks at times like today, where prices are reasonable, you're not going to see those sorts of crushing losses. You may see a 50% loss, but it will not stay in place. It probably will not stay in place more than 10 years. So the odds very much favor your plan working in those sorts of circumstances. Anyway, that's why I prefer tips and I-bonds as a general rule. And I look at certificates of deposit when tips and I-bonds don't do the trick. See, what I think you should be doing with tips and I-bonds is looking for good returns. I locked in my tips and I-bonds when I could get a real return of 3.5% real, which I know from the historical evidence is a very good return. So I locked it in. I took 30-year tips. If you can't do that, and you can't get a decent return on tips or I-bonds, certificates of deposit can sometimes give a short-term deal that's not so bad. So you're taking a little gamble there because they're not inflation-adjusted. So, I bought some certificates of deposit at one time that were paying a 7% return, And the inflation rate turned out to be, I don't know, 2%, maybe 3%. So I was getting a real return of 4 or 5%. Those were five-year CDs. So I was getting a real return of 4 or 5%. Very good return. Better than my tip return. But I was taking on risk because the inflation rate could have been 7% and I would have gotten a return of zero. And I was taking a risk. It worked out, but you wouldn't want to have all your money, you know, in certificates of deposit. It's better to have the inflation adjustment if you want to have the if you want to have stability, which is what you want as your counter to stocks. Now, can you do better with bonds? My belief is if you research bonds, you know, how they work, what's available, you know, going for the best bonds, all this sort of thing. If you spend a lot of time researching it, I think it's like anything else. It's like picking stocks. I recently did a podcast on effective stock picking, saying that, you know, you can do it despite what John Bogle tells you. Can be done. I think the same thing is true with bonds. I think you can probably get a better return. If you're going to study bonds, you can probably do better than you would with TIPS or I-bonds. You are taking on that extra risk, that inflation risk. But you can counter that risk, you know, through the use of human intelligence, by effective research. But it's going to take a lot of work. And most of us are not inclined to do that work. And even if you are inclined, you could spend those hours picking stocks effectively and probably get a better return that way. So I'm not sure it's worth putting the time in. If you like the idea of researching bonds, by all means do it. And I see no reason why you can't, why bonds can't be every bit as good a counter to stocks as TIPS or I-bonds, or even better. But if you're not going to put the time in, and I think there are a lot of reasons for not wanting to do so, there are probably better uses for your time. TIPS and I-bonds are awfully simple. They're awfully simple asset classes. So I think of TIPS and I-bonds as the perfect counter to stocks. So that's the direction in which I lean. Now, another point that I would make that I think is a very exciting point, and I want to explore this in a separate article, but I'll get to it someday. It's not the first thing on my list, but I think it's important. The conventional reason for using bonds as the counter to stocks is that bonds are safer than stocks. I think that conventional wisdom can now be questioned. It's not so clear to me that conventional wisdom is even true. The reason I say that is we have done a statistical analysis of how risky stocks are when you follow a valuation-informed approach. And the answer is not too risky. People think of stocks as being this high-risk asset class. And if you ignore valuations, as the passive investors do, it's quite true. Stocks are an extremely risky asset class if you invest in ignorance. I don't say that to be mean. That's what you're doing if you invest passively. You're investing ignorantly. You're ignoring the most important factor, which is valuations. If you do that, stocks are a high-risk asset class. What if you consider valuations? What if you invest in a valuation-informed way? The risk of stocks is reduced dramatically for valuation-informed indexers. And the way I try to quantify this is if you look at 20 years out, the passive investor says, we can't know anything. We're know-nothing investors. We have no idea. Valuations doesn't help us. We have no idea what a return's going to be. Zero predictability. Valuation-informed indexers look at the historical data, and they say, let's presume that stocks are going to perform in the future somewhat as they always have in the past, and let's try to predict our return. Well, it's not possible to predict your return 1 year out or 2 years out or 3 years out. It's possible at five, but the numbers are not statistically significant. At 10 years out, they are statistically significant. At 15, they're very good. And at 20, they're extraordinary. At 20 years out, there's a statistical measure of how predictable something is. And at 20 years out, stock returns are 78% predictable. That's compared to 0% predictable for passive investors. So if the risk is the unpredictability, which I think is a fair way to describe risk. If the risk for evaluation-informed indexer is 22%, compare that to a risk for the passive investor of 100%, and the valuation-informed indexing is only one-fourth as risky as passive investing. We've reduced risk by, you know, three-fourths. Well, if we reduce risk by three-fourths, are stocks still riskier than bonds? I'm not at all sure that that's true. I think if you invest in a valuation-informed way, stocks may well be less risky than bonds, or at least comparable. So I'm not sure that bonds are a sensible counter. In other words, if you're willing to take on the risk of bonds, maybe you should just take on the risk of stocks where you get higher returns. I do think you do need a counter to stocks at times of high prices. But I think the more effective counter is the asset class that is truly not risky, which is TIPS or I-bonds, possibly CDs. What you're doing is, what you're trying to do is to invest in something with no risk. Bonds are sort of a middle ground. They're viewed as more risky than, say, a money market account, but less risky than stocks. They're a middle ground. What I'm saying is skip the middle ground. Go with the rock stable class, TIPS, when stocks are too risky, you know, to be acceptable. And then as soon as stocks become acceptable, switch over to stocks where you're going to get the bigger return. Don't go into that middle area. That's my thought. That's my tentative belief. But if you prefer the bond route, I don't have any big argument with it. I just personally, it's not the direction in which I am pulled, and I want to do more research and come to a better understanding of all this. But my inclination is to combine a rock stable asset class with a high risk asset class, a high risk / high return asset class. I like mixing stocks and TIPS, or stocks and I bonds. You know, where practical considerations favor I bonds. But I don't object to the bond idea, but I'd like to see more analysis of it. And one of the things, you know, we're trying to do with these calculators is to make that sort of analysis more doable for people, so that people can plug things in and try to find out. But most of the research we do really focuses on the stock side, and we compare stocks. What we try to look at is how risky it is to have certain stock allocations at certain valuation levels. But our counter is usually TIPS. That doesn't mean you have to go with TIPS. You see, I think some people have that misimpression. They look at the calculator and they think you have to have TIPS to do this, and you don't. What you have to do, you have to have some asset class that will provide a real return of whatever you're assuming TIPS would get. So if you're plugging in 2% real as your TIPS number, well, then you can go with TIPS that provide 2% real, or you can go with anything else, bonds or CDs or whatever you please, as long as it will give you 2% reliably. Or if you're plugging in 3%, you need 3%. If you're plugging in 4%, you need 4%. So you don't have to go with TIPS. But the reason we use TIPS is that to analyze the question, you need to plug in some number that you're sure of. And with TIPS, you can be very sure of the number. So the benefit of TIPS is stability. That's really, in summing up the message of this podcast, what is it you're trying to counter when you're investing in something other than stocks? The default position, I would say, is to invest in stocks, best long-term return. The problem with stocks is instability. So your counter to stocks should be the most stable asset class you can find, and that's TIPS I-bonds. If you study bonds enough so that you can transform bonds into a stable enough asset class to serve as your counter, bonds might give you a better deal. But you've got to be willing to do the research. If you're not going to do the research, I would lean towards TIPS or I-bonds, but there might be times when TIPS or I-bonds just don't offer a good enough deal. And then you either have to wait until they do, which usually doesn't take all that long. Or you might try bonds in some circumstances. And I haven't studied what those circumstances would be enough to offer definitive statements. But it was a great question by Colleen. I'm grateful for the question. And I hope that, this offering of some tentative thoughts on what you should be invested in when you're not investing in stocks is somewhat helpful. Please go to the website, look at the materials there, ask questions. Ask questions about the podcast. I love to hear from people. I love your feedback. Good luck with your investing strategies. Take care.